So why don't we turn to a couple other things? One has to do with the schedule, and I was wondering what you thought about that. One of the things that was a little surprising to me was that the next court date is not until December. Now, obviously, there has to be discovery. There has to be an opportunity to make motions. And you and I have talked about this, which is that's what due process requires. And the rule of law requires that any defendant, whether you like the person or don't like the person, there has to be time to prepare and to get material. And the government has an obligation to turn that stuff over. I was a little surprised that the government wasn't pushing for sort of a faster schedule. The court even made a comment about this as a, and he didn't quite use the word leisurely, but that was sort of the drift of it. And by the same token, if you're Donald Trump and you're sitting there saying this is a witch hunt and I'm innocent, he could have asked for an immediate trial. I've been in cases like that where a defendant goes to court and says, "I'm ready, let's go." I mean, this is not a case where Donald Trump doesn't know what the facts are, and there wasn't a lot of build up to what was going on. But it's sort of an obvious point. But if he really thought he was innocent, he could have his day in court really soon.
Although that would not be his style at all. His style in litigation is delay, 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 as we've seen now for years. And certainly in the Mar-a-Lago investigation, saw all kinds of efforts to delay. But you're right. The government started out very early on saying, we are hoping for a January 2024 trial date. And I think my recollection of the response was by the defense was, well, that's really aggressive. And then they got down to breaking this into pieces. And I think I first thought December 4th for the first hearing was kind of crazy, and what was going to take so long. And I do think part of this is just New York practice. The judge talked to the parties about how long was it going to take for the government to provide discovery. The other assistant district attorney spoke to the phases of discovery that they were going to be providing. That means evidence that they're going to be turning over the defense so that the defense can examine all of that. The defense, so they said they could do that in about 65 days. Defense counsel then said, well, we would need at least 6 weeks after that in order to file any motions. He actually wanted to file motions in phases. The judge says, I don't want to do phases. I'll give you till August 8th to file all your motions, which means discovery's got to be done in ample time for the defense to file motions. I'll then give the government till September 19th to file all of its responses. I'm then going to set December 4th as our next court date. And then what he said is, if I don't think I can get to all the motions before that, I'll let you know. So that told me he's planning to basically rule on the motions on the papers and be ready to announce his ruling on December 4th, or maybe ask some questions and get some clarifications if he needs to before ruling. So, and I don't know if you took it that way, but then the timeframe made more sense. It's not like nothing's going on till December 4th. Lots of things are going on. And the parties may be having to go to him if there are discovery disputes, or it could be that if they're filing a motion for a change of venue, they'll argue this really should get decided before December 4th. Although he seemed like he wasn't interested in ruling on motions before that. But I think we'll see there'll be lots going on. And in many ways, in a case like this, and this is something that the judge said, these things take time. And even the judge thought January 2024 might be a little bit early for a trial date.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, the one thing I had in the back of my head was this idea of what's called a superseding indictment. Pure speculation on my part. What a superseding indictment is just additional charges that get added into a case. I'm not sure that's going to happen, but the tea leaves on this are that this case, the so-called hush money case, had a statute of limitations problem, meaning that the case has to be brought within a certain amount of time or you're out, meaning the law is basically you get peace and repose after a certain amount of time. And this case had that issue. And so it had to be brought by a certain time. It's going to definitely be litigated as to exactly what that time is. There are various ways in which that time frame can be extended, whether you're absent from the jurisdiction or because of COVID. So that will get litigated. But that was the reason why this case had to be brought. If you're in the DA's office, you're thinking, I have to bring this as soon as possible, even if I'm investigating other crimes as to which there's a longer statute of limitations. So we do know from interviews with the prior DA and other reporting that there certainly was a larger financial investigation. We know about some of that because Letitia James, the attorney general in New York has a civil case with respect to that large financial case. And so there's some possibility that what's going on is that they brought the case that they needed to bring and was ready to bring now, and that some aspect of that financial case could still be brought and potentially folded in or not in a, either as part of this indictment or as a separate indictment. But that's one where it's certainly speculation, but they have a lot of time. They have a lot of runway in which to do that. And one other thing I just wanted to address, because it keeps on coming up from Donald Trump's team, is the issue of change of venue. This is an issue I actually, Mary, I'm patting myself on the back a lot today, but this is one where I actually know the law, and it's actually been litigated all the way up to the Supreme Court from the Enron case, which I worked on 20 plus years ago. And in Enron,
God, that was, it doesn't seem like it's been that long, but okay.
Yes, yes. So, you know, it's funny. At times I think that, and at times I think, oh, it does feel that long.
True.
So Jeff Skilling was the head of Enron, and he claimed that the Enron case should have been moved out of Houston because he couldn't get a fair trial in Houston, even with a lot of procedures to vet all the jurors. And what the Supreme Court said with respect to that issue is that that's something that that could be an issue if you've got a crime in a particular location where, let's say, you know, murders in a small town where there's such inflamed passions that it really needs to be moved somewhere else where people haven't heard about this, they haven't followed it as much, and you really increase the chances of having a dispassionate jury, which is what you want to have. Obviously, you don't have to have a jury that's never heard of the case. You just need to have people who can decide it based on the facts and the law and not what they've heard outside of the courtroom. And in the Enron case, what the Supreme Court said is, really, where are you going to go? If you remember at the time, this was huge national news. And it's not like you could sit there and say, oh, you know what? In New York, they haven't heard of it. Or in Maine, they haven't heard of it. Or in Wisconsin, name your state. It's known everywhere. And that's this case. You know, so what Trump is really saying is what Paul Manafort said, which is, can you please move this to a place where there's more Republicans? You know, Paul Manafort actually was pretty bold. He just said, can we just move it? And then he just cited the number of Republicans versus Democrats in Washington, D.C. versus in Virginia. And he even wanted it in a certain location in Virginia where there happened to be, you know, more Republicans.
This is pretty much what Donald Trump said, too, right? Like, yes. I got 1% of the vote in Lower Manhattan, and therefore there shouldn't be any case there. I mean, he hasn't officially moved for a change of venue, but I thought, I don't think change of venue is based on people's political voting or their politics at all, frankly. So I think that's going to fail if and when it is made for all the reasons you've just indicated.
There was a judge in the district I grew up in the Eastern District of New York, who at one point turned to a defendant and said, I have two words for you, denied.
Right. Yeah. No, that's good. And, you know, we're making light of it, but it's actually important, right? It can't be that the law says, oh, if you have political leanings that are different from the defendant, you can't be fair and impartial, right? Because change of venue is about, as you just said, it would be impossible to get a fair and impartial trial or a fair and impartial jury. And we cannot have a system where the politics of the defendant and the politics of the jurors are what governs fairness and impartiality. The jury selection system under law presumes that really it starts from an assumption that everyone can be fair and impartial. And if they have things in their own personal background or history or some sort of superior knowledge about the case or a connection to the defendant or the defendant's family, those are all kinds of things that they will get asked about during voir dire, the jury selection process, and always ask, can you be fair and impartial? And, you know, most of the time, if the potential juror says yes, a court will deny a challenge to that juror being on the jury. And then if the defendant or the government wants the person off the jury, they'll have to use what's called a peremptory challenge. But I'm getting way ahead of myself. Now I'm talking about the trial. So we can get there when we get there.